Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello, good morning. Years and years ago, when I was hiding from the last recession at university, I did a bit of philosophy. And when I started going to lectures, I remember thinking, this is all that stuff I used to think about when I was a kid. In inner city Brisbane, there's a small primary school where philosophy has been introduced to all its classes. And there's plenty of evidence to suggest it benefits the children socially, academically, and even emotionally. And it's even good for the teachers. The woman who introduced this radical change to Buranda State School is Lynn Hinton, and she's my guest today. She's the principal of the school. And in case you're wondering how something as seemingly esoteric as philosophy can help children, well, just think about the questions philosophy asks of us. How should I live a good life? What does it mean to be a good and moral person? How can I bring rational thinking to a problem? And the best one of all, where do your thoughts go when you've finished thinking them? Lynn Hinton's won a whole bunch of accolades for her work at the school, and teachers are coming to Buranda State School from all over the world to find out what on earth it is that she's doing and why it's working so well. Lynn, good morning.
Good morning, Richard.
I just realised I don't know the answer to any of those questions I posed to you earlier. After teaching philosophy for all that time, are you closer to the answer to some of those questions?
Well, no, but that's not the point, I suppose. Hearing you say those things... I think it was Socrates who said, it is no small matter, but how we should live our lives. And that's what we're doing.
They're the truly big questions, aren't
Absolutely.
They?
It's Absolutely.
It's funny, we think these things all the time, about these things all the time as kids, these big things. How far does the sky go up?
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean for forever? What is time? Mm-hmm. What does each moment mean? You think about these things all the time and you lose it as you get older, don't you?
Because no one gives you the opportunity to actually explore them with other people, because everybody else is thinking the same thing. So we actually take the time and stop and explore those ideas.
For years and years, there have been writers who have been subversively trying to insert philosophy into the minds of children through, you know, great children's literature. And I'm thinking here of Lewis Carroll. I've got two kids, and I'm at the stage with my daughter now, who's younger. I read to her from Through the Looking Glass, and that chapter on Tweedledum and Tweedledee, there's my favourite part of all of those books, is where they tell Alice to be quiet because the Red King is sleeping under the tree, and if you make too much noise, you wake the Red King up. And since we're all just figments of the King's dream, we're just things in his dream, if he wakes up, you go out like a candle. And I read that to both my kids, and it really disturbs them. It delights them,
yeah.
and pleases them. And in the end, I ask them, who's real, Alice or the Red King or none of the above? And they don't honestly know.
Yeah.
There's plenty of preparation in children's literature, Lynn, isn't there?
There certainly is. And we do base a lot of the work that we do on children's literature because it's the things that the children are familiar with. I can remember, just getting back to what you were saying about whether things are real, I can remember having a discussion with children about what's real and what's not real, and how do you know this is real? I mean, how do you and I know this is real? In fact, you know, it doesn't feel very real to me because this is what you do all day, every day, so it's real for you, but it isn't for me.
No, it's just the media.
You know,
yeah.
My natural habitat is, you know, wearing rabbit ears and singing Home Among the Gum Trees, not this. But I remember saying to children, well, you know, how do you know this is real sitting here? You know, can you prove to the person next to you that actually you're here and this is real? And that was very interesting. There's lots of pinching and going on and that sort of thing to, you know, if I can feel it, then I must be here. I must be real, you know. It's interesting.
So what you're talking about there, that's something, you know, you learn in philosophy is Cartesian doubt.
Cartesian doubt, indeed.
Do you call it that? Or do you ever...
With the older children, you can. What we're not doing is actually talking about the history of philosophy. What we're actually doing is engaging children in philosophical discussions.
So it's practical philosophy in that sense.
Absolutely. Practical. But with the older children, you can get to a stage where you're having a discussion and you can say, well, you know, you people think this, as did such and such a philosopher. But you people, on the other hand, think this. And that's what it is. So what they're learning is that there may not be... it may not have been resolved, this question, already, and that great thinkers still couldn't agree on the nature of truth or whatever.
Do you have to prep the kids before you even start talking about it? How do you prepare kids to engage in philosophical discussions, Lynn?
We prepare children by doing what you alluded to earlier, and that is reading stories. We get junior fiction stories in the main, and there's lots of very, very good prepared materials. A story, for example, an Australian story, The Bunyip of Barclay's Creek, right? You read that one to your children?
No, I don't remember.
You need to do that. The author actually was a philosopher. But it's about, you know, the Bunyip's wondering, you know, am I handsome, you know? So that gets you into, well, what is beauty? And it's different for everybody, and is that okay? And then he says, am I real? And so the man looks at him and you know, says, well, no, you can't be there because Bunyips don't exist. And, you know, and so you say to the children, well, are there questions about this story that you'd like to ask, you know? And the children will say, well, how do we know when something's real? And so that then becomes the basis for the discussion. Or they say, what does it mean to be handsome? So that becomes the basis for a discussion on that occasion.
Do you go that step further and say, well, the Bunyip's a character in a story. Is the Bunyip real?
Well, you do. It depends if the children take it there, you see. Our job, I think it's running a philosophical discussion with children, I think, is a quite a nice and accurate analogy. And it's like being the conductor in the orchestra, where it won't work well without the conductor. The philosophical discussion won't work well without the teacher. But at no time does the conductor lift up an instrument. At no time does the teacher give their opinion. The teacher is actually directing things. And the teacher is there saying, well, now, have we made an assumption here? Should we go back and have a look at that again? Can someone give me an example of that? Can we find any counterexamples to test that? So that's the role of the teacher. It's quite different and it's quite tricky, but it's really important.
Lynn, you must need super bright teachers to do it. Seriously.
Well, all my teachers are super bright. All my teachers are fantastic. But it does take a lot of work to learn. It's not easy. It's not something you can pick up in a couple of days. You have to keep on wanting to be better at it. And we do, once a month, we have a community of inquiry in our staff meetings, which is quite interesting. But we also focus on a specific skill that, you know, teachers will say, well, I'm not doing too well with testing analogies with my class. Can someone talk to me about this? And so we spend time in our staff meetings focusing on how people are doing this. There's a lot of sharing of ideas. If teachers are not feeling comfortable, they might say, well, will someone come and watch me and tell, you know, give me some feedback on my sessions, or can I go and watch someone else in my non-contact time? So there's lots of sharing. It does, because we're all learning this together, certainly in the early days, it does make for a really good, I suppose, professional learning community, if you want to use the jargon.
Do you use the old, in teaching, do you use the classic Socratic method? Do you just, you know, fire questions and ask, which I suppose what a good interviewer ought to do, ask difficult questions that will seem to contradict the opinion stated by
that
person?
Well, you sort of do. I mean, well, you're alluding to Socrates, and he used to wander around the marketplace, you know, and stop passers-by and test their beliefs until it got to the stage where they really couldn't be sure of very much at all, you know, and so that's when you get to, well, I think, therefore I am. You know, I know I'm real because I'm thinking, and, you know, I can show you. But we're not actually trying to trip the children up. We're trying to say, well, you know, what do you think about this? You know, how do we know when something's real? And someone will say, well, something's real if you can see it. Well, who agrees with that? You know, does anyone have any other ideas? Is that the only thing you need? Are there, you know, can you think of an example that where there's something you can not see but you know it's real? So then you get into thought. Well, are your thoughts real? Is air real? You know, yes, it is, but we can't see it.
Is the man on the telly real? Yes,
that's the other right. And so you sort of, with the older children, we can then start looking at necessary and sufficient. Is it necessary to see something for it to be real? Is it sufficient to be able, you know, to see something for it to be real? Is that all you need? So there's an extension of skills as the children go through the years, so that the upper grades are operating in a very I think a very sophisticated way.
Wow. How young do you start, then?
Prep.
What kind of... Tell me how that goes. How do you read a story?
Yes, you do. You do read a story still. But the point of all of this, Richard, is to have the children engage in good philosophical discussions. Now, in order for that to happen, another analogy, if you like, if you want the children to play a good game of football, you have to take time out to teach them how to kick and teach them how to pass the ball and teach them how to run and teach them how to stay in their position. Put all of that together and you get the game, right? The game in this instance is having a good philosophical discussion with children where they really can examine the big questions, the big issues in their own lives. So we have to stop and teach those intellectual skills, the skills of inquiry.
And what are those skills then? And be polite.
That's a procedural thing, listening, respecting other people's ideas, building on one another's ideas. But there's also the actual hardcore thinking stuff, if you like, that we do sequentially across the years. So in prep, they start work on questions. But by about grade two, they know the difference between an open philosophical intellectual question and a closed textual question.
So they're ready for you by grade two, are they?
Well, yes, they are. In prep, we're also looking at, we teach them to start giving reasons because we're trying to develop their capacity to reason well and make good judgments over the 7-8 years now. So the preps are doing questions, difference between a question and a statement. They're looking at giving reasons and they're practicing listening. I went into the prep class the other day. I had a principal from a close by secondary school, and he was just having a look around the school because we sent some of our children to his school. And they were doing philosophy. I didn't know they would be doing philosophy at that stage. I still don't quite know yet when the teachers do it, but it's timetabled every week. And the teacher had put this eclectic sort of group of objects in the middle of the circle, because children sit in a circle so they can all see one another when we're doing this. And she was teaching them the skill of, well, it's making distinctions, finding things, similarities and differences. And out of this bunch of children, bunch of objects, she'd said, can you see anything in there, two things in there that are similar in some way, are the same in some way? And by the time we got there, there was a blue plastic lid off a milk bottle or something like that and a blue stapler, and the child said, I think these are the same because they're both blue. So then the teacher says, can someone build on this? Is there any other way that these two things are the same? And someone else says, well, I think they're both the same because they're both useful.
Oh, that's great.
And then she says, let's look at the ways in which these things are different. And someone says, well, the stapler has a grey thing underneath and the lid doesn't. You know, and so you're just getting them to focus in on making distinctions.
Are kids better at adults at making those? That's a really quick paradigm shift there, isn't it? It's like both blue and they're both useful.
Yeah.
That's like thinking at right angles, and it seems like they got there pretty quickly.
My kids call it thinking around corners.
Thinking around corners?
Yes, thinking around bends.
Are kids better at than adults, do you think?
Look, I think children are very good at it, but I think that we have to not let them lose it. I think that curiosity and wonderment are part and parcel of childhood that we must encourage because we need them to still be like that when they're adults. I think it's really important, and I think we have to celebrate wonderment and celebrate curiosity and celebrate the quirky and, you know, all of those things. Just an example is I outside my office I put up problems, maths problems, all the time, and the children...
What do you mean, on a board or something?
Yeah, yes, on the board outside my office. And a big sign that says, don't let your brain shrink, think, that kind of thing. So, you know, I put up problems, and some of them are quite hard and some of them are quite easy, and sometimes I put up paradoxes, you know, which really don't have an answer. And the kids like those, you know.
What kind of problems?
An old paradox, a famous one. A barber claims to shave all those who don't shave themselves, but not to shave those who do shave themselves. Who shaves the barber? And when you get into that, it just goes around in circles, right? So that kind of thing. Or the one on the wall at the moment, something like, on a ship there are 26 sheep and 10 goats. How old is the captain? You're looking puzzled.
It's a non sequitur.
Well, you know, it doesn't make sense, does it?
No.
Really doesn't make sense. the little kids will look at the two numbers and add them up, right? Because that's what you do. It's maths, isn't it? Two numbers are not too far apart in size, so therefore it must be an adding. We'll add it, right? That's what they'll do. And if you don't pull them up on that, they'll keep doing that. It's not useful. It's not making sense of what they're being asked. But when I looked in the box where they put their answers yesterday afternoon, I was just delighted to see not enough information to determine the answer. This is a trick question. And the best, Richard, well, his name is Peter, and he lives in Magic Land, and he's 500 million centuries old, and I know this is right because I worked it out. And I thought, she knows I'm having a go at her. She's
That's
doing
right.
the same back to me in a very respectful manner. That's delightful. That's
the right answer, isn't it? Because you made it up. You made up the problem. She's made up the answer.
That's right.
My guest this morning is the amazing Lynn Hinton. Lynn is the principal of Buranda State School in inner city Brisbane, which has introduced philosophy as part of all of its classes. It's having enormous benefits not only on the students but on the teachers as well. Lynn, how does this go through to all the classes, as I've just said? How does this, for instance, become a part of maths? How does philosophy do that for your kids?
Interesting thing, Richard, is that once children are used to operating in this manner, which is actually not taking things for granted, not making assumptions about where we're going, but actually stopping and thinking about the process, it does transfer into other areas. Our kids are very good at problem solving, maths problem solving, for example, because they're not focused on the answer, they're focused on the problem. And we have them do problems together with others, so they talk it over, and they're saying, well, now that might not work. The kind of language they're using indicates that they're really in the thinking process. They're working things out, they're talking things over, they're listening to one another, and there's no emphasis on the answer. The answer might be right, might be wrong. That actually doesn't matter so much. How they get there is what's important. So you'd see them head off in a direction and hit a brick wall and back up and try another way, and they become very adept at that kind of thing.
So that's what real life is like.
Absolutely. Working with others is real life,
yeah.
And that kind of novel problem is real life.
When you encounter problems in real life, there's not always answers to problems.
That's right.
There are solutions,
yes.
or
possibilities.
Possibilities, yeah. But there's never, the answer to a problem in life is never going to be 14, really, is it?
No, exactly right.
It's going to be this and this and
that's
stuck
right.
together, and maybe that's the best solution, isn't
that's
it?
That's right. And
so that's what you're trying to teach then.
What we're trying to teach the children is, among lots of other things, about, it's important that you have reasons for your decisions and all of those things, but that most problems have many possible answers. Right, that there isn't always one correct answer. There may be lots of answers. Some may be better than others, but there may be several answers that are okay.
Nonetheless, Lynn, you're still feeding kids into a curriculum and a school, a statewide examination system
that will
require them to answer 14.
Yeah.
And get there. Can they do that if they're sitting there pondering all the variables behind the equation that's in front of them?
They can do that. They can do that. And I think that our results, our children do well in systemic tests, and there's no reason for that apart from the fact that they're good at what they're doing.
How do you bring philosophy into the timetable of
you do
of
philosophy at least an hour a week every class, and you timetable it, and I know when that will be. It's a non-negotiable. And if we have a week where you've got arts council and school sport and all of those other things that happen in schools, they're not allowed to drop philosophy and they're not allowed to drop maths.
What kind of questions do you get from the kids that surprise you?
Things like, the question, how do you know when something exists, came from a grade 3 child after we'd read The Bunyip of Barclay's Creek. And exists was spelt I-D-I-S-T-S. Because he'd never come across the word exists before. Had never seen it written down. But that was his question. How do you know when something exists?
And what did you say?
Well, let's talk about that.
Let's talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
You opened it up.
Yeah. But then other questions. One of the most... lots of things like, does treasure bring happiness? And, how do you know? Is it always good to be fair? Lots of questions like that. But the one that I still stop and think, goodness, that was remarkable, was I'd read a group of year 5, 6, 7 students, William Tell. And, the mayor, he has seeks vengeance and he shoots the arrow and all of those things. One of the questions from a year 7 child afterwards was, if you seek vengeance, do you lose your freedom and become a slave? And the other children said, well, you know, what do you mean by that? You'll have to explain that question. He said, I just mean that if you set about seeking vengeance, you know, and getting revenge on somebody, do you become so focused on that and obsessed by that that you lose the capacity to operate normally in the rest of your life and you become a slave to the vengeance?
How old is this kid?
He was 11.
This is, the you know, one of the great themes of literature.
Well,
know.
To get an 11-year-old child, you know, yeah, to that point, you just think, what's good about that for teachers, not just me, but for teachers, is to be in a classroom when something like that happens and you think, I allowed this to happen.
So the point of this isn't getting the getting great answers, it's to get great questions then.
That too. Questions are terribly important. If you don't have a good question, you're never going to have a good discussion. And it's not about the answers anyway.
I wonder if one of the benefits of this, teaching philosophy to kids, is that kids aren't like adults. As grown-ups, we're often afraid to ask silly questions. I ask them all the time, of course. But that's my job, I suppose.
We should.
Yeah, kids are, do you get a lot of mileage out of the fact that kids aren't really afraid to fall on their face and ask a silly question?
Well, they don't know that it's a silly question. You know, if someone says there are 26 sheep and 10 goats, how old is the captain? Of course that's a silly question, but everyone's going, now, what do I think about that? You know, well, I know what she's doing. But you know, a silly question, a question that may seem silly to you and me, is just taken in the spirit in which it's offered. And you think about that.
Lynn, I suppose you get some insight into how kids evolve morally too, because, you know, it's said that if you've got a bunch of kids in grade one and you say, well, this person stole from a shop and stealing's against the law and you took property away from that shopkeeper, you know, should they be punished? Well, kids will say yes. But then if you give them another story behind it, well, that man's starving and he needs to feed his family.
Yeah.
And he's stolen.
Yeah.
How do you find that evolves over
well,
time
that's,
with kids?
That's nice. You know, the children go through, we all do, go through stages of reasoning. And we begin with absolutism, for example. Stealing is wrong. I know that. My parents have taught me that. Stealing is wrong. And none of us is about to say, no, actually, that's not correct. But they just say stealing is wrong, and they haven't ever thought about it. When we start doing philosophy with them, they kind of slide into this relativism, you know, where everything's all right. If I think it's okay, and it's okay, and if you think it's not, well, that's okay too.
Everyone can
you
know, do whatever they like, so long as they
right.
don't hurt anyone.
Yes, that's
that one.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
And so we get into relativism, and, you know, I guess that's what you would expect first up. But what we need to do then is move them past that. And so with the stealing example, we might say, well, okay, let's have a look at this. What actually is stealing? And give them some examples. If you take the fruit that's coming over on your neighbour's tree, coming over the fence, and you eat that fruit, is that stealing? So we look for problematic cases, right? If your neighbour's got 6 pencils and you've got none, and so you take one of his and you forget to give it back, is that stealing? You know, is forgetting the same as stealing? If you copy someone's work, is that stealing? You know, for children, the idea that you can actually steal someone's ideas is interesting.
And once you throw that out, do you find this is hotly contested between the kids and hotly debated?
Not hotly contested, but certainly in a very measured and serious manner, discussed. And listening to other people's ideas and building on one another's, you know, saying, well, I agree with that or I disagree with that, but I'd like to give you an example of that kind of thing. So and if you like, it's about epistemology. We're looking at the nature of stealing. What is stealing and what is not stealing? And you might think that something, you know, that borrowing something and never intending to give it back is stealing, and somebody else might not, but we can agree to disagree, you know. But we're getting to the point where we're saying, what actually is stealing? When we then move on to, is there ever a time when it's all right to steal? Then we've slid from epistemology into ethics and values. And that's a different thing again, you see. People often think that philosophy, doing philosophy with children, is the same as values education. But it's not. It's much broader. Part of it involves values education, but it's much broader than that. So we've looked at the nature of stealing. Is it or isn't it? And should we or shouldn't we? Is there ever a time when we should or when we shouldn't or when we might be able to? And so hopefully what we've done is moved them from, if you like, absolutism, stealing is wrong, through relativism to what you might call, if there's such a word, evaluativism. So they've evaluated it. They've worked out what it is. They've thought about it. And while we're, even though we're inquiring together, it remains, in a sense, an individual pursuit because children will go away and keep on thinking about it for themselves.
So then the point then of that, if you're teaching ethics and morals, I suppose you need to be able to help kids arrive to a decision.
That's right.
A morally sound decision.
And they're probably
decision.
Going to end up still believing that stealing is wrong, but they've done that whole evaluation process and with other people and looked at the evidence and thought about different scenarios and looked at all the problematic cases that may not slot easily into or not into. And so you've asked them just to really look deeply at the particular concept and arrive at a point at the end where they may not have changed their view. They may be much more confused than when they started. But it's a good confusion because they're actually thinking on a much deeper level. Does that make sense?
It does, absolutely. And it prepares you for life as a result.
Absolutely.
You're prepared to go out into the world and make those moral decisions
absolutely.
With greater certainty. And you're not likely to get a shock as well when, if you have those moral assumptions, crude moral assumptions
yeah.
made, when they're challenged
when
later in
challenges
life.
Someone challenges it, that's right.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
Today, my guest is Lynn Hinton. Lynn is the principal of Buranda State School, and she's introduced philosophy as part of the curriculum throughout the entire school, and it's having a huge payoff in terms of the outcomes for kids academically, socially, emotionally as well. What is the school philosophy, Lynn? Then there's the core course requirements and there's the philosophy as well. How do you bring them all to the student?
Well, philosophy then? Obviously feeds into everything that we try and do. And our original goal with implementing philosophy was to try and improve our literacy and numeracy results. But I suppose I should just say the core business of all schools, obviously, is teaching and learning. Core business is literacy, numeracy, all of those things. And, you know, nobody shies away from that. That's what we do. What we're also trying to do by teaching philosophy and by some of the other things that we do is we're trying to not only provide that absolute core, because we have responsibility to the children to do that, but we also are trying to have them leave our school with a good sense of self, with the ability to work respectfully with other people, with the beginnings of a social conscience, with the ability to solve novel problems, and also with a good understanding of the practical and ethical implications of environmental sustainability. And to that end, the last one, we have a vegetable garden and we have chickens and the little children, well, we all grow vegetables, everybody grows vegetables, and they sell them to the teachers and to the parents, and the little children collect the eggs from the chooks and make egg sandwiches and sell them to the teachers. So philosophy fits into all of that. You know, it's about well-being, it's about making people feel valued and important, and then it's about intellectual engagement, which is where you get your student achievement.
It's said that the results improve the children's lives emotionally. That's interesting. Emotionally, how?
Well, you see,
is
I think
confidence?
Having a good sense of self is important. Knowing what you're good at, what you're not good at, is important. So, you know, it's having. I just think that having a good sense of self is a good thing to do. You know, you're talking to someone who really probably doesn't have that. You know, I'm here under pressure. But that's okay.
I don't believe you for a minute, Lynn. You'd have to have a good self. There's clearly a lot of confidence. You're
what is good, though, about this is, what we didn't expect, we really were trying to do something about literacy and numeracy, and that happened. But all the other stuff was unexpected and really awesome in the true sense of the word. Very early in the piece, I remember a researcher was at the school and he said, you know, out in the playground there, your kids don't fight, they negotiate. You know, so what they're doing, those skills that we were teaching them or teach them in philosophy, to listen to one another, try and see things from other people's points of view, to reflect on your own behaviour and your own learning, were spilling over into the playground. And we didn't expect that. But we saw this lovely kind of settling happening not long after we started doing this in the classrooms, and that's, you know, maintained.
All right, Lynn, you with your shaky sense of self, which I just don't believe for a minute. I want to get into a bit of your background now. What were you like at school as a kid?
Pretty ordinary. I remember, well, I just wasn't terribly interested in it, actually. There was nothing interesting. There was nothing that was very engaging.
You grew up in New Zealand. Was it a meat and potatoes kind of school? Was it? You were just getting the basics, and that was it?
And that
was enough?
Yeah, well, you know, that was what I was offered. It wasn't exciting. I do remember having a maths teacher in fifth form. I can still see her face. But I remember sitting there one day and thinking, I just love this. You know, this is sequenced and it's ordered and it makes sense. And I just, you know, next year's teacher wasn't so good, but I never lost that love of the kind of the order of maths and the sequence nature of maths, but juxtaposed with things like paradoxes and chaos theory and, you know, the quirky stuff. And, you know, that's what I love. That's
you liked maths and the quirky end of maths as well.
That's right. The side of maths which is surprising, that kind of thing.
Lynn, tell me what your principal wrote on your final report as a student.
Oh, it was one of those moments, you know, where you think, actually, I don't like that. You know, like I just kind of coasted along. I got to the end of high school. And I'd passed all the things I needed to pass, not by very much, but I remember my father saying, the secret of passing exams is knowing how much work to do to just get passed. That's when I passed one exam with 2 marks. And that was very generous of him. But that was all right. I didn't do much work for it. But what she wrote, the principal wrote on my final leaving report, Lynn is a pleasant girl of average ability. And I don't have any problem with what she said. I looked at it and I thought, she doesn't know who I am. That's a safe thing to write about somebody that you've got no idea about, or you don't even know who they are. And I thought, I've been in this school for 5 years and she doesn't know who I am. And I felt, I suppose, a bit hurt by that, but certainly angry with myself as well, thinking I've coasted through this place for 5 years and that's all she can find to say about me. And I didn't like that.
She'd forgotten who you were, so she figured you must
have been... I don't think she ever knew who I was.
An innocuous person then.
Yeah, I must have been average ability because I hadn't, you know, distinguished myself academically, either at the top of the pile or the bottom of the pile.
So what did you do?
And I must be nice.
So that's it, quiet, steady worker.
Yeah.
C+.
Yeah.
That's the thing. I got that for woodwork once. I remember that. I thought the teacher doesn't know who I am either.
I mean, my best mark was maths, but it wasn't high enough for her to say, oh, gosh, this person's obviously clever.
So what did you do when you left school then?
Well, for 6 months I just went into an office and sort of punched a machine. Whoops. But then I soon realised that wasn't going to keep me entertained at all.
You're talking about punch cards, I hope, rather than
actually
thumping a machine.
I'm talking about punch cards. If I felt like punching, I thought, no, I can't do this. So I don't know how I found out, but they were seeking applicants for teachers training college at that stage. So I thought, oh, I'll go along and see what this is about. So I got into teachers' college, and that's how I became a teacher. And I absolutely love it. I love the job now as much as I did when I first started.
Why?
Because of the kids. Because they say, you know, well, his name is Peter, and, you know, he lives in Magic Land. That stuff, you know. And yet, yeah, you know, that's what I love. I love it when the children come dashing into the office and say, I've thought about something. I've thought for every right answer, there's an infinite number of wrong ones. And I sit there and think, that was great. Or, you know, I've thought of a question I want us to put on the wall. What is it that makes me, me? And I think, oh, don't you love that? Or overhearing a couple of little prep children last year, walking along behind them, and one of them says to the other one, they're four, these children, I really love reasoning and philosophy, don't you, Doug? You know, and you think, oh, where am I? You know, this is fantastic.
That's great.
It's great.
That's
why I love the job.
Why wouldn't you? That's fantastic. Yeah. Lynn, tell me how you started to connect philosophy and teaching with children, this idea. How you started to put those two ideas together.
I had discovered maths early on, and when I came to live in Australia, I had to go back to university and upgrade my qualification so I could teach here, which I did. And then I carried on and did a master's because I still had children at home and I wasn't able to go into the workforce full time. And you know when you go to, you sit in on your first lecture and the lecturer introduces themselves him or herself. And I remember sitting in this maths lecture, and this the lecturer said, and it told us a bit about herself, and then she said, and I'm also very interested in philosophy for children, but that's a different story. And that immediately grabbed my sense of, you know, philosophy and children in the same breath. Isn't that an oxymoron? You know, is that, how could you do that? Philosophy, it just appealed to me, that notion. But I didn't do anything with it then because I wasn't in a position to do so. When I got my first, this school, when I was appointed a principal for the first time, I thought, well, this might be the time to have a look and see what this philosophy for children stuff is all about, which is what I did. And, you know, the results of the school of the children's literacy and numeracy needed to be, you know, had a bit of a boost, and I thought, well, this just might do it. So we did that.
It was always your intention to be a principal of a school, wasn't it?
No, not really. No? I never sort of had intentions. I think my life's been fairly serendipitous. I've been fairly lucky. And
but once you had your doctorate and you thought, well, school's for me?
A principalship's for me? No. What was for me was being somewhere where I could make my own decisions and not have to do what somebody else said. Not that I mind doing what someone else says, but I thought, how would I be if, say, for example, if I was a deputy and the principal told me to do something that I didn't think was a very good idea, I'd have to do it, and, you know, and I would do it. But I thought maybe I'd rather be the person who makes those decisions and tells other people to do stuff.
And that's a philosophical question too, an ethical one, isn't it?
It's an ethical one. So I actually applied for this school, which was what was called a Band 5 school because it's a very small school, and I applied for a couple of principal's positions, deputy principal's positions, which were Band 6 and therefore higher paid and, you know, better jobs supposedly. And I was offered 3 of them, and I said, thank you very much, I'll have the Band 5. And I remember my boss at the time ringing and saying, do you realise what you've done here? You've knocked back 2, you know, higher positions. And I said, I know exactly what I've done. This is the one I want. Thank you very much. And there I still am.
What was the school like when you first arrived? Because it's an inner city school in Brisbane.
Inner city.
Yeah, near the Gabba. It's
near the Gabba, high crime area, low SES area, high migrant area at that stage. The area is changing now with gentrification because it's only about 3.5 kilometres to the centre of the city. It was empty. There were 48 children there and a room for a lot more than that.
48 kids?
48 kids. And so really it was an opportunity, you know. I thought, well, we can really do something here, but let's just see. There were 2 other teachers.
So where did you start?
I started with saying to the other 2 teachers, what's your passion about teaching and learning? What would your ideal school look like, right? Because if you know teachers, most of them have gone into it because they have this passion about kids and their learning and what they should be doing and what would make a good school and what's good for children for the future, etc., etc. And I asked all the children, what makes a good school? How would you like your school to be? And then we also asked the parents for their input. What makes a good school?
You obviously had to get the numbers up too.
Well, yes, because there were 48 and the magic number was 50. In state schools, they have day 8 effective enrolment, which is, you know, how they decide their staffing. And with 48 children, we were entitled to 2 teachers, and with 50, we were entitled to 3. So I had to get, I needed 2 more students or lose a teacher. That's just, you know, that's just the game, the numbers game. How did I get them? Well, I made some posters, and I put them over around in the shops in Stone's Corner, you know, in the bakery and in the chemist shop, and things like, I said, something about Buranda School with interesting and innovative programs, thinking, I'm going to have to do something about that claim now, aren't I? So I put them up over the weekend, and on Monday, someone rang and said, tell me about your innovative programs, which I did. I didn't tell any fibs. And the other child, it was someone's cousin, it was a fairly flexible family arrangement, and it was someone's cousin who came and stayed at the school for 2 years. So that was 50, so we kept our teachers.
Lynn Hinton is my guest this morning in conversation. She's the principal of Buranda State School with a very innovative curriculum and process. So there you were, you're up and running, you had your 50 kids. Then 10 weeks into being there, something happened.
Something happened, yes. I was coasting along nicely there and having a nice time. and trying to learn what a principal is supposed to do, because I thought there was this job called principal that I had to learn, and I was trying to learn it and also be a teacher at the same time. And then what had happened in my family was, in my extended family, was my mother had died about 12 months prior to this time of cancer. And so as a precaution, myself and my siblings were told to just go off and have a check, you know. So I went off and in April of that first year and discovered that I had the same cancer. So that was kind of obviously unexpected and shocking, and suddenly school's no longer important. Your life just goes a different direction and you don't have any choice about that. So I was actually in hospital for some months, and I had quite a number of fairly substantial operations, and got back to school part-time about term four that year and full-time the following year. And an interesting thing happened because, you know, when you're in a situation like that, whether you know it's happening or not, things are changing in your head. You know, you're looking at things differently. I think that we are reflective beings by nature, and we don't stop and give ourselves time to do it. And something like this forces you to do that. You know, I'm a great believer in, if you've got an important decision to make, you just sleep on it and it makes itself eventually. You know, you wake up in the morning and think, ah, that's what I'm doing. So I think that we are, you know, inherently reflective creatures. Anyway, before I got sick, I was trying to learn this role called principal, you know, and decisions would come across the desk and I'd think, well, now what does a principal do in this instance? And, you know, trying to do it right. When I'd been back at work for a few months, and I'm talking about quite some time later, like I was away for most of that year. So the next year, I found that things had changed, and I thought, this is interesting, I'm not operating in the same way anymore. Decisions would come across my desk and I'd think, what do I want to do here? So this whole notion of me having to change to fit the role of principal had gone, and what I was doing was changing the role of principal to fit me as a person. And I think that's where things started to change. That's when I started to take risks. Not really serious risks, but that's when I thought, well, you know, the reading I'm doing about philosophy indicates that this is what might be the outcome. Well, that's what I want. Let's do it, you know. And so it just kind of changes subtly the way you approach your life. I also had this, you know, this idea, well, what's the worst that'll happen if, you know, my bosses or whatever really don't like what I'm doing? Not just at school, but everywhere. What's the worst that'll happen? Well, at school, worst that'll happen, well, I'll get the sack. And I would think, well, actually, that's okay. I could deal with that. It actually doesn't matter because I'll find something else to do. And you get that kind of courage from, I think, for me, having been through a life-threatening experience, you know, and a very uncomfortable experience and, you know, coming out the other end.
For a philosopher, you ask lots of questions about your own mortality and life on Earth, and I suppose those become much more pressing questions when you've been given a diagnosis of serious cancer.
Yeah, so they do.
What happened?
Well, suddenly you think it's this is not actually other people, it's me. And here I am, and you see people sitting in your hospital room crying, and you think, this is about me. You know, they're upset because of me, you know, and it changes your whole focus about yourself and the way you relate to other people. Well, I'd like to think that. But it's different and it's interesting.
Did it change some of the answers you had in your head?
No, it probably evoked more questions, I'd say. It also gives you a much greater sense of uncertainty about some things and certainty about others, if that makes any sense.
No. Tell me a bit more about
that.
Thank you.
Uncertainty about, you know, what is the meaning of life? What are we all here for? It raises lots more questions about that. And certainty about the fact that there is only today, there is only now, there is only this child that you're talking to at this particular moment. There's understandings like whatever you say to a child will be with that child forever. So you have to be careful what you say. You know, it will be with them when they're an adult. I bet you if you thought back, Richard, about your schooling, you could tell me a time when an adult said something mean to you or that you thought was unfair or unjust. You know, if you ask Year 7s, give me a highlight of every year, not necessarily a positive highlight, but something you remember about every year, one thing. I've never met a Year 7 child who hasn't got something to say like, well, in Year 3, I got blamed for, you know, breaking the school window and it wasn't me. You know, there's always one of those. So it is critical to give children a fair hearing and to let them know that you're giving them a fair hearing. Then deliver the verdict if you need to, but they must be heard. And so the kinds of things that become certainties are the influence and the impact that you can have as an adult on a child. And that's huge. And that has to be kept in mind at all times.
I wonder if that principle of yours, when you were a kid, would ever have imagined in her wildest dreams that some, I don't know, 40 years later, a casual remark like that in a report card would be brought up on a radio program like this,
yes,
70 years later.
Fair enough.
Well, we often ask people to fit into lifelong reflection on this program, and the things that always come up are either a brilliant teacher that inspired them to do better or piqued their curiosity, or a teacher that said something unnecessarily foolish and hurtful. So that's what you say is very true, Lynn.
Yeah, I would like to think I never did that to a child. But, you know, maybe it spurred me into action. I don't know. Yeah. Perhaps it was useful. You have to look at the positive side too, don't you?
Principal of Buranda State School, Lynn Hinton, is my guest in conversation. So there you are. You're running this course. And how has this affected enrolment at the school, the introduction of philosophy at all levels of the curriculum for the kids?
Well, for whatever reason, enrolments rose fairly quickly. I would like to think that some of that was for philosophy and our results. Some of that I know is because we have a really good environmental education program. I would like to think some of it is because we take great pains to make the children feel comfortable and valuable. And, you know, it's about establishing, as I said earlier, well-being, making children feel like this is a good place to be, and then expecting huge things of them academically and intellectually. Because that contributes to their sense of self. I think if you said, what am I the most proud of, it would be that the children like coming to school, they like learning, they're responsible for their own learning, all of those things.
You started at 48 kids. How many kids are in the school now?
Well, we have 215, but that's because that's all we can fit. Last year, I think I turned away upwards of 50 prep children because we didn't have room for them. I mean, you know, the idea of state schools is to provide education for the local area. So essentially we take children in the catchment. If we have room, then we take siblings. And if we have room after that, we then take children from outside the catchment off the waiting list.
Do you ever get complaints from parents? Do they ever come to you and say, you know, I've just come home from a hard day's work and I've got my kids saying, what's real, what's not real? They're telling me I can't step into the same street fight. I've got no answers for them. My kids are making me feel like a dill. Are you getting complaints?
They say things like, some very interesting topics are raised over the dinner table these days, you know, that kind of thing. I haven't ever had a parent complain about philosophy.
Well, Australians are very pragmatic people, and historically we have always been like that. You know,
that would be a generalisation.
Put all that stuff. It is a generalisation, yes. But you know, there's been that great theme, let's say, that's definitely there in Australian culture. Put all this stuff, this esoteric nonsense aside. Get out there and kick a footy. Do you ever experience that kind of pressure, Lynn?
No, but what that does bring to mind is a nice comment I had from my admin officer once. I put a new problem up on the wall outside my office, and a group of Year 7 boys were there at 3 o'clock, you know, school had finished, arguing about, you know, what was the right answer. Well, let's say, you know, who shaved the barber. And she called out and she said, this place is nuts. Those kids should be out in the yard kicking a ball. And they're in here arguing about maths. It was great. So it's not just about maths or just about philosophy. It's about getting them thinking. It's about getting them not taking things for granted. We're not teaching them what to think. We're certainly not teaching them what to think. We're trying to teach them how to think.
Lynn, I just have to ask you, since I know you love maths and you're teaching philosophy as well, do you ask kids whether numbers are real and that if everyone on the planet died, would numbers still exist?
I haven't asked them that. I certainly have asked them, what is a number? And that's interesting. I haven't asked them if all the numbers... I have asked them, if all the clocks stopped and the whole world would time stop, you know, those kinds of things. But I will ask them about the numbers.
The numbers and maths exist independently of human beings. That's a question.
It's like the tree in the forest.
And what do you think?
What do I think? I'll need time to think about that. I have to reflect on that. Thank you, Richard.
You're doing extremely well. That's the first question you've dodged after nearly an hour in conversation.
That's too big. That question's too big to answer like that.
Do you get any cases of bullying in the school?
Well, we do. We always do. But I would suggest that we get far less or far fewer cases than certainly we previously did.
Are you likely to get intellectual bullying under these circumstances? Like, clearly, my friend, your reasoning is wrong because this, and this. Why don't you?
No,
just
you know, I've not seen that. Maybe when they get older and understand that they have that kind of capacity that perhaps other people don't. I don't know. I haven't ever seen that, and it's never occurred to me.
And it's attracting international interest, what you're doing, isn't it?
Yes, it is, yes.
Are other schools picking up this as an idea?
Other schools are picking it up. Once our results started to change and the school started to grow and, I don't know, word of mouth, we started to get requests from people to come and visit. And as I said earlier, you know, we have core business at our school, at all schools. Our core business is teaching and learning for our children. Those 215 children are ours and they're our responsibility. But if it's possible to have visitors come to the school and sit in on a lesson without disrupting the children, then I don't mind that, provided the teacher's happy with it. And the teachers are always happy with it. The children are proud to talk about what they're doing. They love the idea that what they're doing is special and other people like to see it, because really the only way you can understand the power of this is to see it. So yes, we do have a lot of people come to visit. We then have people saying, well, I'd like to do this too in my school. So we have all of my teachers have done what's called a teacher educator certificate, which involved a week or 10 days at maybe Melbourne University or somewhere like that, in order that they can teach other teachers. So we do that. We do a lot of training here and overseas. We've done training in Suffolk in England. We've done training in Singapore.
Well, may your word spread all over the world, because this is a brilliant, brilliant thing, obviously, Lynn, and it's clearly delivering for kids in your school. It's been great to meet you. Absolutely fascinating, in fact,
Lynn.
Thank you so much for being with me in conversation today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Lynn Hinton, and she's the principal of Buranda State School. And thank you very much to Tom Baird, who emailed me about Lynn. Thank you for that suggestion. It's midday.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.